Complaints against the king. I mean, the book of Matthew. What's the main big picture idea it's trying to get into your head? There's a king and he's got a kingdom. All right, that's it. And so if you've probably noticed, almost every single title of these sermons, I didn't look it up, but they're all about the king. I mean, when I delete the title, I don't delete the king part. The king's always in there, or the kingdom. Because that's the whole point of the book of Matthew. And as you go through it, if you're looking at a section and you're not seeing the king and the kingdom in there, you're missing something. This section is about complaining against the king. How many people have ever complained against God? Oh, come on. I know you probably all have. Just a few of us? Yeah, there we go. I like honesty. I'd rather you be honest than humble. Honesty. So, what do we have? Here we are. This is the first story. This is the story of Matthew. He gets called by Jesus. Jesus is going along, and there's Matthew at his tax collector booth. Tax collector, the way that it worked as a tax collector is you purchased a segment of the roadway or an area from Rome. Rome would say, we need so many dollars of revenue for this place. And so they would sublet it out. And let's use Todd, for example. Todd, the tax collector. So let's say the state of Washington said, we need so much revenue from this particular area. And they wanted, let's say, $10 million from this area. And Todd could bid on that. He could say, I will raise the $10 million in this area. I will pay the state $10 million. That's how this would work. Now, he then needs to go to everybody in this area and raise the $10 million. And a little more for himself, because that's how he makes his living, all right? So a tax collector could make, well, as good a living as he wanted to, because if you didn't pay your taxes, Todd gets to call the state out against you. Matthew could collect the money, and if you didn't pay it, the Roman army would make you pay it. So he could set the rates for that area. Now, different areas would have different tax collectors with different rates. This is Matthew's job. He works for Rome. Of course, he's a popular fellow, right? Because you all love tax collectors, right? You love it. You love paying your taxes, especially when they're extra. Jesus comes to Matthew and he says, follow me. Matthew gets up and he follows Jesus. And then we get to this next little picture. They're at Matthew's house. And of course, it's saying they're reclining at table. They, remember, the way they ate there, they didn't sit in chairs and around a table like we do. They had low cots that they would lay on. So you would lay down and you'd rest on your left arm and you'd reach in to the table that would be in the middle. And you'd reach in and gather the food back to yourself. So they're reclining at the table. And I love this part. This is just beautiful. Many tax collectors and sinners came. Who wrote this book? Well, presumably Matthew wrote it. Can you imagine Matthew's writing this book about himself? And I had this party, and I invited all the tax collectors and sinners. You know, he gets to put that in there. And I think he's doing it just kind of like, all right, you Pharisees, watch what I'm going to do here. I admit it. See, he's not hiding anything. He said, yep, and I threw a party and I invited all my friends. What a bunch of sinners. And Jesus was there. Isn't that neat? I like Matthew's honesty here. Jesus and his disciples and Matthew and the tax collectors and the sinners were all together. And the Pharisees saw this. They said to Jesus' disciples, it's always interesting sometimes. We're going to see the disciples in here. They don't go to Jesus. They pick on the disciples. Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? See, this is where I think Matthew got the words for it. The tax collectors and the sinners. When Jesus heard of this, he said, those who are well don't need a doctor. How many people went to the doctor this week because you were perfectly healthy? And you showed up and the doctor said, what can I see you for? I just missed you. Right? Well, he's going to send you to another doctor. Those who aren't sick don't need a doctor. The sick people need a doctor. And then Jesus says, go and learn what this means. And that phrase, go and learn there, go and learn means It's a thing rabbis would say to their disciples. I want you to go study something a little more because I think you missed the point. It's a catchphrase. Jesus is saying, go and learn what this means. And then he quotes the Old Testament, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. Jesus didn't come to call righteous people into his kingdom. We didn't have anybody to call. He only could call the sinners. So this is our first complaint here. The first complaint against Jesus is that he associates with sinners. Aren't you glad? Aren't you glad? If he didn't associate with sinners, you wouldn't be part of his social group. Do you associate with sinners? Yeah, I got kids. All right. So anyway, one of the things you note about Matthew is who he invited. He didn't invite the Pharisees. He invited people like himself to come to the party. You know why Matthew invited the tax collectors and sinners to his party? Those are the only people who are going to come, right? This is why when people first become Christians, you know, you still know a lot of non-Christian people. You know, your social group is full of people who are tax collectors and sinners. And then after you've been a Christian for several years, what happens to your social group? Changes, doesn't it? Changes. And suddenly you're useless to God because you can't reach anybody. You know, the best time that you have in reaching people for Christ is when you're new to the faith. After that, it's work. You've got to look for ways to meet people. I have a hard time connecting with non-Christians because of my job. All right. But as your value system changes, so does the social group you're part of. Matthew's going to see that. What happens to Matthew as soon as he begins to follow Jesus? What happens to him? I mean, just be honest here. He becomes part of this 12, which is part of a larger group that follows Jesus, and they go on this 3-year or so mission, and they're out walking around together. Matthew's social group changed, didn't it? His value system changes. Now, later when he's going to go out, he's going to go out as a missionary for Christ and go out and preach the gospel to people. But the immediate group he was part of, I don't know if he's ever going to be back with those. This first chance he gets, Jesus is coming to his house, is a very important one. And if he misses out on it, he'll never get it back. Most of us missed out on that, didn't we? Or so long ago, we don't remember it. That's why it's important to tell people about Christ. Invite them to your house. Say, I'm inviting all the tax collectors and sinners to my house for a party. You're invited. I want to teach you about Jesus. No, don't say it like that. Matthew does. I like his honesty here. But Matthew, he was in league with Rome. And the Jews didn't like that about him. The Pharisees complained against Jesus. And Jesus quotes back to him, Hosea 6:6, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. This is interesting. It reminds me of a verse in Psalms, a verse that David wrote. David, after his sin with Bathsheba, of course, what was the sacrifice you gave at the temple after you committed adultery to have your sins forgiven? You remember? We just studied Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Do you remember that sacrifice in there? There wasn't one. What died? You did. That's right. You get to die. You see, there was no sacrifice for this. And what does David write in the Psalms? If there was a sacrifice, I'd bring it. But there wasn't. And what does he talk about? He talks about the mercy of God. God, you're merciful. There's this new window into God. He should have been put to death. Bathsheba should have been put to death. Solomon never should have been born if they had followed the law. But they didn't follow the law. God was gracious to them and merciful to them and forgave them. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Go and learn what that means. Jesus declares that people are more important than religious rules. even the Jewish cult. Even cult, you know how I'm using that. You remember I taught you about that? Even following the Jewish sacrificial system, Jesus is saying people are more important than that. It's interesting because I just gave you the story of David, right? God didn't strike David and Bathsheba dead. God didn't command that they be stoned. Something else was going on there. David was a prophet, and he was beginning to reveal more of what God had for the people of Israel. Except for these Pharisees were a little behind the times, 1,000 years. Jesus would rather the Pharisees were more merciful and less, quote, righteous. You see, they were too righteous. They were righteous in ways God wasn't wanting them to be righteous. Of course, true righteousness is being like God. That's what it is. The Pharisees had misdefined that word as keeping rules. But if they had truly known the intent of the law and the prophets, they would have been more merciful. The Pharisees imagined a Messiah who was coming that would destroy all the unrighteous and reward the righteous, them. That was what they were expecting. Jesus didn't fit their model. Well, why not? Well, if they understood these things about mercy and righteousness, the Pharisees would have known their own failings a little bit more. That would have been the first thing that would happen. Our attitudes of condemnation reveal how good we think we are compared to others. Every time you condemn somebody, that's you saying, I'm better than that person in this way, shape, or form. That's just what the language means that you're using. When the Pharisees are condemning Jesus, they're saying, Jesus, we're more righteous than you are. What they didn't know is they were saying they were more righteous than God. Boy, that's a tough position. The reality is that we lack likeness to God in the moment we think we are more like Him than others are. When we condemn others without mercy, then we have ignored what Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount, that God has only two solutions for people, judgment and mercy. Which one do you want? By the measure you use, so shall it be given to you. The lack of mercy in the Pharisees revealed that they were under the judgment of God. They were living as judges. They would receive judgment. The Pharisees' ultimate failure was rejecting the doctor by declaring themselves well, while they were truly sick. When you're sick and you don't go get go see the doctor, you stay sick, depending on the kind of sickness you have. If it's the sickness Jesus heals, then you stay sick. But they stood there saying they were all right. Until we recognize our own sin and the depth of it, we cannot be forgiven, and we live in judgment over others. The second thing the Pharisees needed to see was that they should not have rejected the sinners. See, the two parts of it. They didn't realize how bad they really were, and they didn't realize how they were really supposed to be treating other people. A self-righteous attitude pushes sinners farther away from God. Do you know why? Because it misrepresents Him. When Christians have a self-righteous attitude and they walk around judging everything, saying God judges it, even if He doesn't, you're actually pushing people farther away from God. So look at the Pharisees for a while. Look at how they were treating the tax collectors and the sinners. And compare that to Jesus' work or John the Baptist's work. When John the Baptist went out to baptize people, who was going out to him? All these sinners were. He was reaching the people with truth and getting them to change their lives because he was offering them the mercy of God. The Pharisees, on the other hand, were offering people the judgment of God. And these people were being pushed farther and farther and farther away. They weren't making new disciples of these people by calling them sinners. They were pushing them farther away. Well, that's the first complaint. The second complaint comes from, well, a more unlikely source. The disciples of John the Baptist. Now, the first time it was the Pharisees going to the disciples of Jesus. Now it's the disciples of John coming to Jesus. It's interesting. Even among believers, and I'm not saying the disciples of John were believers in the fullness of the sense, But even among believers come a false idea of what true spirituality is. And that's what's at stake here. What does it mean to be spiritual and know God? When the disciples of John came to Jesus, they said this, "Why do we and the Pharisees fast?" They're lumping themselves into these people that Jesus just condemned. It's interesting. "Why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples don't fast?" Here we are, we're keeping all these fasts and we're going without food. Why is that? And Jesus says, "Do wedding guests mourn?" How many people go to a wedding and you're mourning for this event? Now, it happens occasionally if you think it's a bad marriage. But generally speaking, all right, when the parents have arranged a good marriage. Generally speaking, at a wedding, it's a time of celebration, okay? It's a time of joy. That's the intent here. And Jesus is saying, how many people, when the bridegroom is there at the wedding, are you mourning? This is a depressing situation. Can the wedding guests mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast. Who's Jesus saying he is here? This is interesting, because he's saying he's the bridegroom. He's saying, "I am the bridegroom." Well, this is messianic language. Again, he's taking it and applying it to himself. He's not just inventing new language here. This is language that they would have already understood. He's declaring himself to be the Messiah by using the language that he is the bridegroom. Now, I wonder if the disciples of John were not also thinking about Jesus and tax collectors here. Now, of course, they're a little bit more merciful, but they don't. But they also show maybe a little more jealousy. The disciples of John are a little, presented on a few occasions, a little jealous of Jesus, because they see Jesus is taking away some of John the Baptist's disciples. Jesus is becoming more popular. He's getting more of a following than John. And now John, of course, we're told, doesn't have that same attitude. He says, "I must become less and Jesus must become more. He must increase and I must decrease." So we don't see that. But I think the disciples of John are a little bit on the edge, right, with Jesus and the disciples. But Jesus declares that his disciples would fast when he's taken away from him. A little early, you know, to interpret this as being Jesus telling his disciples he will die. I mean, he knows he's going to be taken away, and we can read that into here, but the disciples, this is still too vague a reference to his death. Later, Jesus will come right out and say that he's dying and how he's going to die. After the resurrection, the disciples may or may not fast. It's interesting. When Jesus is taken away, I think of that as the crucifixion. That's when the bridegroom is taken away. And at the resurrection, the bridegroom's given back. So some people will say Christians will fast, well, after Jesus. They didn't fast when Jesus was with them, but then they would fast after the crucifixion up until today. Or you could say that they were only mourning between the crucifixion and the resurrection. Now, we do see that fasting is taught elsewhere in the New Testament. Christians certainly practiced it. What's the purpose of fasting? I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Why do we fast? There's many reasons for fast given in the Old Testament. Usually it had to do with mourning or repentance or something like that. Certainly that would be something Christians could do. But fasting is more an issue of hunger, right? How many people have ever fasted? Did you get hungry? Good. Well, that's pretty normal. All right. Did you get crabby? Yeah, there. Yeah. I fast to become crabby. No, that's not why I would fast. Why do we fast then? We fast because we're hungry, or we fast because we're full? Well, the real reason we fast, and I've taught on this in the past, the real reason we fast is to become hungry for something else. That's why we fast. We fast to become hungry for something else. That's why fasting isn't just about food, although we talk about it in terms of food primarily. Fasting can be from everything. You can fast from television, entertainment. You can fast from sports games. You can fast from people in your life. There's lots of things you can fast from in order to focus your attention on all that energy and all that hunger and all that attitude and all that desire toward God. That's the purpose of what fasting is about, to focus your hunger toward God, to put it back where it belongs. We satisfy our hungers in too many junk food ways in life, and then we're not hungry for what we should be hungry for. That's the nature of what fasting is about. Fasting demonstrates a hunger for God, that you want God more in your life. So it's not merely a thing about food. Fasting for the Christian is a voluntary thing. It's not mandated. It was mandated under the law. There were maybe periods of time people would need to fast, or fasting for a dead relative, or whatever the situation might be. For a Christian, there's no legal mandate to fast or not fast. You're not more spiritual for fasting or less spiritual for fasting. It doesn't make any difference in terms of whether you should do it or not. It might make a difference to you whether you do it or not. It is useful for seeking God by removing distractions from life. But don't think that fasting only has to do with food. I would dare say in our lives, fasting from food is less effective, maybe, than fasting from other things. The one thing that fasting from food does is you can't go very long before remembering why you're fasting. And every time your body says, you know what, I'm hungry, you take that thought and you turn it around, I'm hungry for God. So there's this constant reminder. Now, if you're bombarded by entertainment and you can say, oh, I really wish I could be entertained in this way, you can say, no, I want to focus my attention onto God and in prayer or memorization or study or reading or whatever the case is for you and what you want to do in terms of that fasting. But this isn't really a sermon on fasting right now, because I want to talk about the next part here. So Jesus illustrates what he just discussed, and he uses two illustrations. And he, first of all, says, when you're patching up clothes, you got this old worn garment and you've managed to get a tear in it. Do you take a piece of unshrunk fabric and put it on the shrunk fabric? Well, he says, of course not, because when you wash it the next time, that new fabric is going to shrink and it's going to tear the old fabric even more. It's going to make matters worse. He tells them another illustration. You don't take new wine and put it in an old wineskin. Now, a wineskin was a body of a goat, okay? So they took a goat that was dead and they skinned it, and it would be seamless if you did it the right way. And then you could tie with cord the feet, you know, the leg parts. And then you could put your wine in there and sew it up all tight. And then as it sat there and fermented and turned from being grape juice into being wine, what happens? It gets bubbles in it, right? It would ferment. And what happens? It gets larger. That skin would get larger and larger. It stretches out like a balloon. And then after the wine was ready, you could open that up and take the wine out and drink it. Now, if you took a wineskin that was old, that means it's already been stretched out once. If you fill that one and stretch it out again, what happens? Well, it breaks open because it can only stretch so far. And what happens? You've destroyed the wine. It's ruined. And the wineskin is destroyed as well, if you had some other purpose for it. But you always put new wine into new wineskins. That's why it has the word skin in there. Okay, now you understand all that background. What's Jesus' point with these two illustrations, which really mean the same thing? Jesus is speaking about the law and the kingdom. The old covenant, the new covenant. I don't care how you want to break it down and how fine you want to, you know, grate the language here. But he's talking about the law and the kingdom. They are similar, unshrunk cloth, shrunk cloth, old wineskin, new wineskin. They're similar, but they're not exactly the same. They're not compatible. They're similar, but they're not compatible. They have similarities, but you can't mix them in with each other. They both teach values, and they both reveal God, but they're intended to work independent of each other. That's what Jesus is saying. The Pharisees and the disciples of John were following aspects of the law when they fasted. And Jesus is saying, you don't need to follow the law anymore. You have something that's similar but different, and they aren't compatible. In my kingdom, you aren't following the law anymore. You're following the things in my kingdom, with new cloth and new wine, no longer the old things. Jesus doesn't intend that his disciples live by the law, but by the rules of his kingdom. That's a very, very important thing to understand. If you don't believe me, just look to what Paul's understanding was completely that. Go read what Paul writes in Romans and Galatians. What does he say? when he went and established churches among Gentiles, he didn't teach them to keep the law. It was irrelevant. He didn't need it. They didn't need it. They didn't need the old. What they needed was what was new, and that's all he gave it to them. And when somebody came along and tried to get his converts, his Christian converts, who were in the kingdom of God, to become Jews, he reacted very strongly against them. He said they were not preaching the gospel and they were under a curse. The cloth and the wine. The Pharisees saw the tear in people's lives, but they didn't have anything to patch it with. That was the problem. They could look at people and say, "You're a tax collector, you're a sinner." They could see the problem in the life. They could see the tear, but they had nothing to mend it with. When Jesus is saying, "I got a whole new garment for you. We're not going to patch up the tear in your life. We're going to get you clothed with something new, something better, something fresh, something that will endure." Jesus' teaching and value system were not to make the law more easy for people to practice. It was to get rid of it, to cast it off, consider it worn and torn and replace it with something new. That's what he was doing. The disciples of John were still too connected to the law. Remember, John was the greatest prophet of Israel, but he was still an Old Testament prophet. He revealed Christ and he preached repentance, but he was still calling for a return to the values of the Old Testament. That was all he could do. Jesus hadn't come and revealed the kingdom yet. But Jesus was greater than the Old Testament. He had authority all his own. It's one of the ideas that we've been talking about over the last few weeks. When he spoke, he could lay down a value system for a brand new thing, a new kingdom. So when he spoke, he revealed truth that was greater than the law. He wasn't trying to pour new ideas into an old system, because they aren't compatible. He had something completely new to celebrate, because he was the bridegroom. There was new wine to celebrate with. I like that passage. It's great.